And good morning. This is Midday from Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm Mike Mulcahy, and today for Gary Eichten. Today we continue with our Meet the Candidate series. Campaign season officially begins in Minnesota on March 7th, precinct caucus night. Of course, the campaigns have actually been up and running for some time now, almost a year, in fact, in this case. Between now and the caucuses, we've invited some of the candidates for U.S. Senate and governor to come in and talk about the issues and to take your questions. Today, we're joined by a DFL candidate for U.S. Senate, Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar. She was first elected to the county attorney's office in 1998. She announced her candidacy for the Senate in April of last year after DFL incumbent Mark Dayton said he would not seek a second term. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. If you're listening in the Twin Cities, give us a call at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the metro area, call us toll-free. That number is 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. You can also get your question in online. Just go to minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question. Amy Klobuchar, thanks so much for coming by today.
Well, Mike, it's just great to be on nearly the year anniversary of the beginning of this campaign. It's been quite a journey.
So for the rest of us, we're just getting started. You've been doing this for quite a while.
I have. In fact, I remember last week I was thinking it was the annual Eel Pout Festival up on Leech Lake, and that was the day my husband and I drove up there at the invitation of the Cass County Attorney Earl Moss and his wife to go to the festival, and we were in Earl's Fish House on Leech Lake, and this is after all the way up on the cell phone, people were talking about the race, and someone had just said to me, you know, you'd have to be a millionaire to do that. You can't do that now unless you're a millionaire. And I got into the fish house, and Earl says, well, what do you think you should do? And I said, well, you know, I think I'm going to do it. I said, what do you think, Earl? And he said, what the heck, go for it. And then he put another ice line, fishing line in, and we never caught anything, but that was when I decided to do it. So it was good advice, and it's been an exciting journey. We've been all over the state, and whether you're talking to farmers in Clay County or workers in Duluth or small business owners in Rochester, they're basically saying the same thing, that they want to see change in Washington, D.C. They want to send something that's going to get something done for people instead of for the big oil companies and the big drug companies.
Well, you have never been a legislator before. Why did you decide to run for the Senate instead of another office like Attorney General or Governor or something like that?
You know, when you're on the front line every day, like I am and our staff is, when you're prosecuting crimes, you see the effect that policies in Washington have on everyday people. You know, when they decide to cut cops programs, when they decide to cut funding, you can see what happens. And you can see what happens to our schools when kids don't have after-school programs. Their lives can change just because of one decision made in Washington. And I believe that that kind of experience that I have on the front line and the experience taking on tough fights and winning them is going to be really helpful, whether it's when I took on the insurance industry, so we got a 48-hour hospital stay for new moms and their babies, or took on white-collar crimes by beefing that part of our office up. It gave me faith that government can get things done. And that's what I want to bring to Washington.
Well, now you brought up your staff. And of course, this has been in the news this week that the leader of the AFSCME local that staffs your office wrote this letter when AFSCME was considering whether to endorse you. And AFSCME statewide did endorse you. But the letter was pretty nasty, said you were kind of a bad boss, taking credit for other people's work and damaging morale, things like that. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, you have to understand, Mike, that this came out of a dispute over salaries. And that particular local, which is our lawyers, was asking for a 22% increase. The commissioners looked at this, I looked at this, and they ended up getting a 10% raise to a 15% raise. Their wages have been frozen for 2 years. This is a group of lawyers that deserve to be compensated. They do great work all the time. 70% of our lawyers now make over $100,000 a year. But we had to balance the salaries of the secretaries and other people in the office and make a decision. And 97% of the lawyers in that group approved that contract. So there were some people that were still angry and were loud about it. And I have to tell you, we hire aggressive people, spirited people, and when they're mad about things, you hear about it. And that doesn't in any way detract from my view of the good work that they've done. Have I pushed a lot of changes? Yes. When I came into office, I wanted a 50% increase, at least, in jury trials, and we saw that. I said I wanted to decrease the amount of money we spent on outside law firms. We've done that to the tune of about $850,000 a year in savings for the taxpayers.
So what difference should it make to the delegates or the voters if some people in your office are, you know, have a poor opinion of you or and are willing to put it in a letter?
Well, first of all, there are a number of people in the office that have a good opinion. I think there was a letter to the editor yesterday, and I don't think that one letter should be viewed as the views of the entire office. But I think what the people of the state need to know is that I have moved toward accountability, and that's been my goal, more accountability to the community. You talk to police officers, you talk to police chiefs, we've dramatically changed how we do business in the county. We have seen, along with the work of the police, community groups, an over 20% decline in serious Part 1 crime in Hennepin County. So I look at results, and it's not always easy managing 400 people. You're going to get some people that are mad at you, and that's part of the job. When I go to Washington, there's going to be plenty of people mad at me. Drug companies, oil companies, because I'm going to push change there too. And I think you want to put someone in who's going to focus on results and get effective results for people. And that's what I've done as county attorney. And I know that I haven't made everyone happy in the office when I've done that, but I've always had in mind the people that I represent. And that's what I'm going to do in Washington.
Well, I know that politicians don't like to be labeled, but looking at yourself on the political spectrum, how would you label yourself? Where would you put yourself? Are you left, far left, right, center, moderate?
I've always hated those titles, let me tell you, because I think people can differ on different issues. I see myself as a progressive on fiscal issues. I see myself as a moderate. I see myself as someone that wants to move change. And when you want to move change, that makes you a progressive. And I see so much wrong in Washington, D.C. right now. You look at, say, Medicare Part D. You know, my mom is a retired school teacher, and she says Medicare Part D got the grade it deserved from the beginning. You have, in this case, the results of the corruption you see in Washington. Instead of really moving toward affordable health care and reform, we got this bill that basically was a bunch of Christmas presents for the insurance companies and the drug companies. You know, my mom and other seniors do not want to spend their golden years surfing the internet trying to figure out which of 25 plans they should buy. And then you look at the cost. Estimate came out just 2 weeks ago that the Veterans Affairs Agency, that department, their drug costs, their prices they're allowed to negotiate are 50% lower for the top 20 drugs than they are for Medicare Part D. Some estimates show we could be saving $90 billion a year. Instead, it's going to the insurance companies and to the drug companies. That's just wrong. And so that's just one example of what we see when people have gone to Washington. They're dancing with the ones that brung them. That old saying you've heard on the prairies of Minnesota, that's what's going on. And we need to change that culture, and we need to send someone who believes in change and getting things done.
Amy Klobuchar, the Hennepin County attorney who is running for U.S. Senate as a DFLer, is our guest today on Midday, our Meet the Candidate series. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, the number to call if you're listening in the Twin Cities is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're outside the Twin Cities, call us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. Just to get back on this culture of Washington issue for one second, you know, you have raised, last report, I think, about $2.5 million to run for Senate. Mm-hmm. These campaigns are so expensive. One of the reasons Mark Dayton got out was because he didn't want to spend all his time raising money. Presumably, if you're elected, that'll be a big part of your job. How do you change that part of it? I mean, isn't the part of the problem with calling the Abramoff scandal a Republican scandal that the Democrats have to raise just as much money and you go to just as many special interests? And, you know, how do you represent Minnesota when the campaign structure is set up like that?
Well, first of all, I want to talk about the Abramoff scandal. I believe that scandal came out of one party having too much power and too much greed. I see it all the time with white-collar cases. You know, maybe someone first steals a little money from the petty cash drawer, and then the next thing you know, they're stealing millions of dollars from the 401k funds of workers. And it's our job to draw the line in the sand. In Washington right now, you have a case where people got put into office by some of these corporate special interests, and the first thing you know is they're passing bills that give them loopholes and help them out. The next thing you know, they're taking PAC contributions and hiding them and funneling through things so you can't tell where they are. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, they're lying before a grand jury. So I see that this scandal is part of having one party having too much power and believing that they can make the laws and bend the laws and break the laws. Now, as for campaign finance reform, and no one knows this life better than me right now, mm-hmm. because if we were just to say that, well, people that have to raise the money shouldn't go into office, we would have what we almost have now, that the U.S. Senate is a playground for millionaires. Over half of the senators are millionaires or multimillionaires. And that's why when I first started running for this, people would say, are you sure you know what you're getting into? And I sat there at my kitchen table. I still do it. I did it yesterday, last night, and call for money from people. And it's part of the job. And I'm not a millionaire. We're a two Saturn family, and this is what I have to do. I've worked so hard at this, Mike. I've raised $15,000 from ex-boyfriends. And as my husband notes, it's not an expanding base. And so we have done a lot of innovative things with the internet, ways to raise money, small contributions from everywhere in the state. Of that $2.5 million we've raised, $2.2 million is from Minnesota, which is phenomenal. Mm. And it shows the kind of support that we have here. In the end, this will be a national campaign, and we will get national money. That's starting to happen right now. But basically, you have to look at how we've done this compared to, say, Mark Kennedy. Mark Kennedy has had Frist, Card, Hassard, he's had Cheney in, he's had George W. Bush, and we just found out this week he's doing an event with Karl Rove. And the only celebrities we've had are the Gear Daddies Band of Austin, Minnesota, whose most famous song is I Want to Ride the Zamboni. So it is a big difference in how we've raised this money, and I'm proud of the grassroots work that we've done and the volunteer network that we have gathered around the state. This is part of politics. I'd like to see reform. I'd like to see some kind of matching funds like we have in Minnesota, like they have in the presidential race for running for the U.S. Senate, because it is an abomination, and it's why we have so many millionaires in the Senate, and it is not representative of the public, and that should change.
Amy Klobuchar is our guest today. She's running for the U.S. Senate. I should mention that Mark Kennedy, the Republican candidate for Senate, will be here on March 2nd, and Ford Bell, the other DFLer in the race, will be here tomorrow. Let's take a phone call. Bob is on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi. According to your website, you say that if the president is unwilling to provide a realistic time frame for the drawdown of American troops from Iraq, Congress should direct the Joint Chiefs of Staff to do so. My questions are, since when does Congress direct the Joint Chiefs of Staff on military strategy during a war? To the best of my knowledge, they never have and probably never will. And secondly, the obviously directly related question is, why shouldn't Minnesotans consider your position on Iraq as being that of yet another Democrat who is spineless and utterly bankrupt on Iraq as you evade taking a stand yourself on a set date for bringing all of our troops home from Iraq this year, next year, or whenever?
Let me give you my views and my position on Iraq. First of all, I was opposed to the war in Iraq. I was opposed from the beginning. This was a war that was entered into with a go-it-alone attitude on the part of the president. Didn't tell the truth to the members of Congress. Now you have Colin Powell and others saying, you know, this is a blot on his career when he testified before the UN. We basically weren't told the truth. We were told there were weapons of mass destruction, and there were not. We were told the mission was accomplished, and it was not. So from the beginning, I've been opposed to this war. I think it has taken us from matters that are very important, like Iran and North Korea and other things that we should be focusing on that are enormous threats to us. Secondly, I believe that there needs to be accountability for the lead-up to the war. We still haven't gotten all of these facts out in public when we've had over 2,000 Americans killed. We've spent over $300 billion, and we have lost countless Iraqis. Finally, I do believe that we need to see a significant change of course in Iraq. this year, and I have called for a drawdown of the troops. I did ask the president to have a more specific plan than we have now with benchmarks. We haven't gotten that plan, and that was one of the reasons I said, well, you know, if the president is going to do it, at least Congress can call in a hearing and ask the Joint Chiefs of Staff to come up with some ideas on how to bring our troops home. As for the deadline, I know many people would love to bring our troops home tomorrow. I would love to do that, too. But we have to do this in a responsible way. We basically went into that country, and we destroyed their police force, and we destroyed their army. And now there are people that would just like us to come out tomorrow, and I don't think that's responsible. What I'd like to see is the UN, especially in light of what we've seen happen in the last few days, the UN, NATO, some type of peacekeeping force, maybe from regional countries, to come in there. I believe we would have to be a part of that. That's why I don't at this time call for a specific date for every single troop to come out. I don't believe we should have permanent military bases in Iraq. I believe that we need to show that we are drawing down our troops so that we can ask the rest of the world to come in and help us and show the people of Iraq that we are not going to be a permanent occupying force in that country.
So just to clarify then, you're saying that there should be an immediate plan to...
I say that we should draw down our troops. If the president isn't going to come up with an immediate plan, we at least have to start bringing a significant number of our troops home. But how I differ from, I'd say, some people is some people want to call for they want to bring everyone home tomorrow, or they want to bring home everyone in 2 months. And I just don't believe we can responsibly do that, despite the fact that I was opposed to this war from the beginning. I believe it's wrong. And I actually go way back to September 11th, Mike, when, you know, the president had the whole country unified behind him and the world unified behind him. And he could have looked at the faces of the people in this country and said, you know what, we just suffered a national tragedy and I'm going to need your help. I promised a bunch of tax cuts for the wealthiest, but now things have changed. And I'm going to need to, you know, invest in our infrastructure in this country and homeland security, and we're going to invade Afghanistan and I need you to sacrifice. And all he asked us to do was to go shopping. And he squandered that moral opportunity that comes along so rarely in politics, where you can be bigger than you are and ask people to be part of something that's bigger than they are. And then he continued, I believe, that lack of direction and that wrong change in course when he made the decision to go into Iraq. And now, this last thing I'd say about this is a thought that people are demonizing people who are in good faith trying to come up with ideas, both on the right and the left, of how to bring the troops home. The fact that the Republicans are demonizing some Democrats, like Murtha, who, I don't agree with everything he said, but demonizing them when they're simply in good faith trying to come up with ideas on how we can bring our troops home safely and not leave Iraq in chaos.
Well, do you believe the war is basically lost?
No, I believe that you always want to hope for success. You always want to hope for success. And I see one of the ways to do this, and the Bush administration has been completely ineffective at doing this, is bringing in other countries as peacemaking forces. And if we ask once, we have to ask again, and we have to ask again, so that it is not just about our country.
Just based on what we've seen the last, 24, 48 hours, do you believe that it's headed toward a civil war? And if so, I mean, how does an outside force like the U.S. or any other outside force stop that or fix this situation?
Again, I do not at all approve of the way this war has been prosecuted and conducted from the very beginning. And I think many Republicans have talked about this, Chuck Hagel and John McCain, in terms of the number of troops that were brought in, the information that we had on the ground. And you see a continuation of that right now. But we must work with other countries in the world to try to not leave this country in chaos. We are the ones that went in there, and now, 3 years later, we're seeing more and more deaths, and we simply need to have the world and bring them together and try to not give up here. And I would like to see a significant drawdown of troops. I think that will be part of the solution, but I will not commit to bringing all our troops home tomorrow.
Some other questions about this terrorism issue. The UN says the U.S. should close the prison in Guantanamo Bay. What do you think about that?
There have been significant abuses that are being uncovered there, and you know, I'd want to look at that more in terms of where we'd have other facilities. But there's a lot of concern that people have been held that shouldn't be held. And again, I believe in openness in government, and I can tell you that in law enforcement and what I do, people get pretty nervous sometimes about prosecutors. And what I've tried to do is make reforms that are fair. We have, you know, videotaped interrogations. We've done new things with the way we do eyewitness identifications. And we've done those things to instill more trust and fairness in the criminal justice system. And that's my concern with how this administration has handled this war and these matters of justice, that we have to remember what we're fighting for. We're fighting for freedom, or we're fighting for what this country has always believed in this American dream. And more and more you see an erosion of that, not just in terms of some of the rights we're talking about, but also with the wiretapping and things like that, but also the economy. You look at the middle class right now, and yes, you know, I go out there and I talk to people. We go to the living rooms, and people say, you know, I have a job, but I can't figure out why my kid can't afford to buy a house. Well, that's because houses in the metro area have gone up 25%. Or a small business owner in northern Minnesota, I want to keep health care for my employees, but I can't afford it. Well, that's because health care has gone up at 3.5 times the wage of the average Minnesotan. And nothing is being done to help the middle class. In fact, it just came out that the tax decreases, the wealthiest people making over $1.3 million a year, their taxes went down 10 times faster than the middle class. And I believe there's things we can do here, but it's not going the direction we're going. Mm.
I want to talk more about some of those domestic issues in just a couple of minutes, but just to stay on the foreign policy for a minute, you mentioned the domestic surveillance, the warrantless wiretapping. Where do you come down on that? Do you think the president broke the law?
You know, I am probably one of the only people running for U.S. Senate in the country that has not only authorized a wiretap, but actually gone in before a judge personally and asked for wiretaps. This is against, you know, serious drug dealers and people involved in very violent crimes. And I know that you can follow the law, and you can get what you want when you follow the law. And that's why I'm so concerned about what's going on here. I think there should be an investigation of what happened. And if we need to fix the law in some way for circumstances to make it easier to do it that are still legal, we should do that. But right now, I would say that we need to have an investigation of what went on there, because there clearly something went wrong when many people believe that the law was adequate to take care of that, and then they circumvented it.
Do you think there is more there than has been reported in the press?
Again, we won't know that until we have an investigation. And if people are hiding from investigations, it's very hard to know that.
An online question from James from Minneapolis that was also on my list, and that is, what about this whole situation in Iran right now? Should the U.S. be willing to put up with an Iran that has nuclear weapons?
You know, I would say, to step back a minute, that this is an example of something that kind of got away from us, a big thing that got away from us, and that is because we put so much focus in Iraq, over $300 billion, and meanwhile, Iran has been developing weapons of mass destruction and is not afraid to talk about obliterating Israel and things like that. And I believe that we have to leave all options on the table, military options, sanctions, in order to deal with them, and we have to make this a top priority.
And when you say that, does that mean that maybe at some point military intervention might be required there, too?
I don't believe you can ever take that off the table when you're dealing with a head of this country who has basically said that he wants to obliterate our beacon of democracy in the Mideast, which is Israel.
We're talking with Amy Klobuchar today on Midday as part of our Meet the Candidates series. She is the Hennepin County attorney and is also running for U.S. Senate as a DFLer. And we'll be back with more in just a couple minutes.
Minnesota Public Radio News.
Iran has called on Britain to withdraw its troops from the southern Iraq.
Thoughtful talk that leaves room for your voice.
I'm going to have an 11% increase on my property taxes. Can you help with this?
You bet. You can blame me for about
navigating complex issues and difficult topics.
It wasn't pretty. It wasn't efficient. But it was democracy with all of its warts and all that it demands.
Objective. Intelligent. Minnesota Public Radio News.
And speaking of the news, here's Stephen John with an update of the latest news.
All right, Mike. Officials in Iraq say at least 110 people have been killed across the country in violence that followed yesterday's attack on a Shiite shrine. The victims include 47 civilians who were shot and left in a ditch near Baghdad. More reprisal attacks have been reported at 160 Sunni mosques. The Pentagon says four soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division have been killed by a roadside bomb north of Baghdad. President Bush says the more people learn about a deal to transfer some seaport operations to an Arab company, the more they'll be comforted that our ports will be secure. Mr. Bush says his administration will keep talking with members of Congress from both parties who oppose the deal. At least 47 people are dead in a market collapse in Moscow. Officials have ruled out terrorism and blame the accident on heavy snow. Mexican officials say there's no trace of two miners where they were expected to be found. Rescue workers have been trying to reach 65 trapped workers in a coal mine in northern Mexico since a blast early Sunday morning. The federal labor secretary says toxic gas concentrations are rising as rescuers burrow deeper into the mine. U.S. government figures say a drop in inflation-adjusted incomes in 2004 left the average family income at just over $70,000. The Federal Reserve also reports that net worth grew, although at a slower pace than in 2001 when the last comparison was made. Red River Valley potato growers will be able to ship their products to Japan. That country has lifted its import ban on fresh U.S. potatoes under a new trade agreement. It'll allow imports from 14 states, including Minnesota and North Dakota. Minnesota ranchers are being asked to test their cattle for bovine tuberculosis if they're within 10 miles of one of the five infected herds in northwestern Minnesota. The state is trying to regain its bovine TB-free status and save money for ranchers who ship cattle out of state. Skies should be partly cloudy today. A few flurries in northeastern Minnesota, highs in the teens in the northwest to mainly the lower 20s elsewhere. Currently in the Twin Cities, mostly sunny and 23 degrees.
Thanks, Stephen. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Mike Mulcahy in for Gary Eichten today. Coming up at noon today, we'll hear from former Reagan administration policy analyst Dinesh D'Souza. He spoke recently at St. John's University about anti-Americanism. This hour, we're talking with Amy Klobuchar. She is a candidate for the United States Senate on the Democrat side. It's part of our Meet the Candidate series. Tomorrow, we'll be hearing from Ford Bell, who is the other DFLer in the race. And let's go right to the phones because we have some people who've been hanging on. Larry is on the line from Bloomington.
Hi, how are you, Amy?
Great. How are you, Larry?
Well, pretty good. You know, I got to disagree with you about the scandal in Washington. It's not a Republican scandal, it's not a Democratic scandal either. It's a systematic scandal. You're a lawyer, and I think you know that Jefferson and the Founding Fathers were pretty clear that if you make the government big and give it a lot of power, it's going to attract people who want to use it, and that's going to lead to corruption. And I think we see that pretty clearly. And that kind of becomes personal for me, because to support that huge institution we've got, I am classified in most of the things I see on websites like MoveOn.org as one of the rich. I'm a retired Army officer. My wife's an engineer. And you know what? I don't think that being classified as one of the rich who have to have their taxes increased to pay for programs makes sense. How are you going to address the problem of the size of a government itself automatically leading to corruption, no matter who's in power? And remember, the Republicans are in power now, mostly because of the Democratic corruption scandals back in the early 90s.
Okay, first of all, Abramoff gave money only to Republicans, so let's start with that. But I'd really rather not debate that scandal because I want to go fix things. And when you look at the fiscal management of government and what's gone on here, Bill Clinton left with a $200 to $300 billion budget surplus. George Bush has currently given us a $300 billion budget deficit. And that does not even include the war costs, which are off of that budget. It is, to me, when you look at middle-class families and you look at people like yourself, Larry, who have worked hard, you deserve better than this. We are now paying $800 million a day in interest on that national debt. And here's what I'd like to see to help you and others. First of all, we need to go back to the pay-as-you-go rules that we had during the Clinton administration. What we had then was if you're going to do tax cuts, fine, but you better show how you're going to pay for it. If you're going to do spending, you better show you're going to pay for it. Discretionary spending, it's gone up 50%. We should be putting our money into these major challenges facing us now. Energy independence, and we can talk about that, I hope, more later. Healthcare, affordable healthcare, education. That's where our money should be going. Next, I would lift the ban on negotiation with the prescription drug companies. $90 billion a year we could be saving with that. Get rid of these subsidies to the oil companies. Look at where the money is going. I always say, follow the money. That's what we do with our white-collar cases in the prosecutor's office. Follow the money here. It has gone to the wealthiest people. I'm talking here about people, you know, making over $200,000 a year. It's made it harder and harder for average families to get by in this country. And I want to go to Washington to help them, to put the people first in front of these corporate special interests.
And so you would roll back those tax cuts, or
I believe we should roll back the tax cuts on the people making over $200,000 a year. I believe we should close these corporate loopholes that allow companies to set up paper headquarters out in Bermuda and allow them to get rewarded for sending jobs to China and India instead of to, you know, Ely and Faribault. Those are the things that we need to look at when we look at what's going on in Washington. It's really, and I know there's always this, you know, rhetoric that somehow Democrats aren't as good with the fiscal house. Well, you just look at the facts of what's happened the last 5 years, and that's not true. You know, there's a diner in my neighborhood. It's a motorcycle diner, and it's called Betty's Bikes and Buns. And my family goes there sometimes on Saturdays, and they have this business card. It says, Betty's Bikes and Buns, where lies become legends. Well, what I've seen in this state is that the people of Minnesota are starting to see the lies beneath the legends of the Republican leadership in Washington, D.C. And these include moderate Republicans in our own state that are very unhappy with what's going on. You know, they told us they'd unite this country, and they've divided us as never before. Well, they told us they'd get help working people, and health care costs up 3.5 times, tuition at the University of Minnesota up 81%. Mm-hmm. You just go down the list. These things have not helped 95% of the families in Minnesota.
But when you talk about balancing the budget, or, you know, getting the deficit down, aren't you also faced with this big problem of these entitlements and the baby boomers retiring, and how are we going to pay for that? Can you raise taxes on enough rich people and close enough loopholes to afford all the obligations that the government has?
Well, first of all, remember, we're talking about a lot of money. I just gave you the prescription drug figure. You know, if we roll back the tax cuts on people making over $200,000, we could pay to insure the kids of this country. These are big chunks of money. When you look at tax fairness and some of the things that have been happening, and you really pick apart that budget and figure out where the money is, I think that there is money there. As far as Social Security, you know, the president tried to make it a gamble instead of a guarantee. And you talk about money, that was $2 trillion. In transition costs just to move over to the plan that he had, much less putting people's money at the whims of the stock market. There are sensible things we can do, like raising the cap. And I believe that those things are solvable. Affordable health care is a much bigger problem. Mm-hmm. And I see this, I come at it from two perspectives. One is representing one of the major hospitals in our state. And I can tell you, when people don't have health care, they do have a doctor, and it's called the emergency room, and it's really expensive. I also come at it as taking on the insurance industry. When my daughter was really sick, I got kicked out of the hospital in 24 hours, and I pushed for one of the first laws in the country for a 48-hour hospital stay for new moms and their babies. And I realize what you're up against. You go there, they say they're for it, and then they try to change the effective date for 3 years. I had to bring 6 pregnant women to the conference committee, so when they asked when should it take effect, they all raised their hand and said now, and it happened. So if you really want to get affordable health care and lift that ban on the prescription drug companies, and what I'd like to see is, you know, I'd like to see everyone being allowed to buy into the federal health care plan. There's 8 million people on it now, small businesses who can't afford health care otherwise, to buy into that plan. But if you're going to get there...
And how does that lower the cost of health care?
Well, because you have larger pools. I know Senator Lurie was on your show earlier this week talking about that. You have larger pool of users that can push the companies more and reduce the prices and demand more when they are in a larger group of consumers. So there's actual competition going on. And then we also, again, by looking at where the money is and helping, like we've done in Minnesota with MinnesotaCare, to help some of the families that aren't at the level of Medicaid, we can insure more people and push those companies on the costs.
How do you see the job of a senator when it comes to these earmarks and special projects, or pork, as some people like to call them? Is it to eliminate those, or is it to eliminate everybody else's and bring Minnesota's home?
There's the answer, Mike. There is the answer. No, I think what we need is more transparency. Instead of, you know, these earmarks being attached and no one knows where they are, and they turn out to be, you know, water parks in Iowa and bridges to nowhere in Alaska, I believe we have to have a much more visible discussion and easier to understand discussion of what's going on. Because I can tell you what people care about when I talk to them. They care about, you know, sending their kids to college, and they care about having affordable health care, and they want to not have these high gas prices, and they want to make sure that we're putting money into the cornfields and the energy in the Midwest instead of these oil cartels in the Mideast. And you've got to pick these three or four major challenges. That's what I did when I came into my job, working with our great staff in the county attorney's office to push certain things that we wanted to get done, you know, career offenders, reducing outside counsel. You pick the big things you want to do and you get them done. That's not what's been happening in Washington. It doesn't mean that some of these projects aren't worthy and that we should look at them and that you want to make sure there's fairness across the states. But when they're not even really voted on and every senator and congressman just gets to, you know, have their own little group of Christmas presents that they give out in the state, I don't think we can afford to do that anymore when we are facing such major challenges in Washington. I believe we should have a 20% renewable standard for electricity. And because they've been spending so much time looking at their own state, we don't have that kind of standard that's going to push the market up to that standard so we see real investment in renewables.
So if you say there are three or four big things that the country should be focusing on, what are those three or four big things?
They are, first of all, energy independence again, getting those standards in place, not being afraid to put them in place. Some of them were in the McCain-Lieberman bill that never passed, went nowhere. Secondly, affordable health care and working on expanding coverage, but also reducing costs and making it so if people lose their job, they can still go and have health care, or they can start a small business and be able to afford health care. Tax fairness, looking at our tax system right now and making sure that middle-class families are in as good a situation as they can be as they're getting crunched and crunched and crunched. And then finally, the general idea of economic and international security, getting at what we were talking about earlier on the show with the priorities and the decisions that we've made that have taxed our military and have not made our country safer.
Let's take another caller. Kelly is on the line from Eden Prairie. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi there. I was calling. I had two questions. One was how you felt, if this is redundant, I'm sorry, on Roe v. Wade. And my next question was about the VA and military benefits for those that have served. It seems I'm a retired veteran Air Force. And it seems to me that the Veterans Administration keeps scaling back because of budget cuts. And now with all our returning veterans coming from Iraq and Afghanistan, that seems to be an undue burden, especially on this Minneapolis VA. It's been pretty hard.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Kelly, and thanks for your service to our country. First, your question was about Roe v. Wade, and I am pro-choice. I believe that this is a private decision that should be made between a woman and her doctor. I will say that I'm one of the things I've tried to do as I get around the state, I have a number of pro-life supporters, some prominent elected officials like Congressman Oberstar, as well as just regular folks I talk to. And I do think that there is some common ground in terms of the desire of both sides to reduce the number of abortions. We've done some good work in our county with reducing teen pregnancies and also speeding up the time it takes for adoption for kids that are in out-of-home placement, and I'd really like to work on those issues, but I am pro-choice. Secondly, you asked about benefits for the military, and that VA's hospital we have is one of the leading brain trauma centers in the country. There are so many of our young men and women coming back from Iraq with severe brain injuries that are now getting help there. And I do get concerned when people sort of wrap themselves in the flag and talk about their patriotism, and then we see cutbacks. I just saw yesterday that of these huge delays we're seeing for veterans, people coming back in getting their college funds and things like that. And that's just wrong. We should be heralding our troops as heroes. We should be funding them adequately. And we need to put our money where our mouth is.
Back on the issue of health care for a minute, we had a online question from John in Prior Lake who said, do you favor a single-payer universal health care plan? And if so, what would you do to make it happen?
You know, I favor universal health coverage, and I think we must have universal health coverage. Single payer is one option, but what I want to see is progress now. And I know when Paul Wellstone introduced his single payer bill, he waited and waited and waited, and he finally ended up introducing a bill to allow states to experiment, and things like we've seen with Minnesota Care. We need progress. I don't want to look at another mom with her kids going to the emergency room because she didn't have any kind of preventative care. She couldn't go in, you know, to get them their checkups and things like that. That has to change. And that's why I have suggested as an initial step opening up that federal health care plan with 800 people to allow small businesses and the self-employed and regular people to buy in. A second step of that is to make sure that our kids have a set level of benefits within that plan or some other plan so that they are covered as well. And we can do that. We can pay for that. We have to have the will to do it, because I can tell you we're paying for it now. Those kids are going to the emergency room in Hennepin County and other places in this state, but they're not doing it a smart way. They're not doing preventative care because they're not insured, and it's costing us more money.
Let's take another caller, David, on the line from Cook. David, you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, Amy, thanks for answering our questions today. I am a Democrat.
All right.
But I do cross party lines because we have some certain specific things. You know, we're called the outstate Minnesota, like we're a foreign country. Up here in northern Minnesota, we're solidly Democrat, but we do like to hunt and fish, and that requires guns, and our guns are always on attack up here. And even with conceal and carry, you know, we have a long time before we're going to get a response. I believe we have the first right to defend our family. How are you going to answer those issues?
Okay, well, first of all, you know, my roots are up on the range. My dad grew up there. My grandpa was a miner, and then he was a logger, and he was a great hunter. I have run into people that have told me stories about his hunting trips. And I can tell you that I'm going to do nothing to hurt hunting and nothing to take your hunting guns away or your guns away. I just think that that's one of those things that you're right there, that people say about Democrats. And, you know, it's just not true. I always like to ask people how much money you think that we spend in the state of Minnesota on worms every year. Well, we spend $50 million, Mike, on bait, tackle, and worms. And it just shows...
But worms don't kill people.
But it just shows how important fishing and hunting and other forms of recreation are to our economy and to our culture in Minnesota. In terms of greater Minnesota, I will say this, is that with my relatives up on the range and my husband and his five brothers from Mankato, if I didn't represent greater Minnesota, I'd have no place to go for Thanksgiving dinner. You know, there was a mayor of Minneapolis named Hubert Humphrey that did a pretty good job representing northern Minnesota and our rural areas. And there was a college professor from Northfield named Paul Wellstone that did a pretty good job representing the cities. We have never let this state be divided geographically, and we have sent people to Washington who believe that one senator from Minnesota can make a difference. One of the committees that I have requested to be on, the first committee, is agriculture and forestry. That's because I know that the Farm Bill is up in 2007. I've had extensive conversations with Congressman Colin Peterson and Congressman Oberstar about this. This is critical. Agriculture is our biggest export out of Minnesota, and we've had trade agreements that have hurt some of our farmers, and I see how critical this is. So I'm eager and looking forward to representing greater Minnesota. Energy is going to be a huge issue.
What about
an
assault rifle ban? Would you support a ban on assault style weapons?
Yes, I did support extending that ban. I worked with some of our police officers and our chiefs on that, and I believe that there was some evidence showing we had seen from the Brady group that we had seen some decrease in the use of those types of assault weapons. We're not talking here about hunting weapons, and we're not talking here about general guns. We're talking about very specific assault weapons, and I want to differentiate that because, you know, this gun issue has been used so much as a wedge issue up in northern Minnesota, and I can't tell you how much I support hunting and those forms of recreation. I think we should be working on developing more habitats habitats so that there can be more hunting in our state. I was talking to a hunter last night who was so concerned that he always was going to North Dakota and South Dakota because we haven't done a good enough job in preserving our habitats for hunting. And this is, you know, under a Republican leadership in our state and in our country, and I think that should be a major focus. And we want to make sure people, Mike, have the money to be able to afford to buy their guns. So when you look at what's happening again to middle-class families, we have to get the facts out there that this is about a systematic change in the way we're doing business in government, where these families have been systematically hurt because of the tax policies and because of the ways that we haven't address their needs for affordable health care and affordable gas and things that they need in their everyday lives.
Well, let's talk a little about the energy issue. When you look at ethanol, is that primarily an environmental issue for you, or is that an economic development issue?
You know, the great thing about the energy independence for Minnesota is that it's both of those things. First of all, it's a national security issue, because if we keep going the way we are, as we're more and more dependent on these foreign countries, it's hurting us for national security. It's making us make decisions that we would rather not make. Secondly, environmental. You look at these the studies on global warming, and you look at what we just found out last week about the ice caps. This is a real problem, and we need to address it, and we can't hide from it anymore. Finally, for Minnesota, it is an economic issue. If we just went to that 20% standard for renewable for electricity, which they already have in Denmark, 5,000 jobs in the wind turbine area in Minnesota. Someone told me down there when I was down there touring some of the wind turbines, they actually have a bed and breakfast down in southwestern Minnesota because people want to come down and see the wind turbines. Mm. It's very exciting. We've always believed in the future and science and technology in our state, whether it's the post-it note or the pacemaker. We've been on the cutting edge through the University of Minnesota and through our farmers and our workers, and we can be on the cutting edge for energy independence in this country.
Now, a related question from Nate, online question. He asks, would you support a national gas tax increase to reduce emissions and reduce dependence on foreign oil and encourage conservation?
You know, one of the things, I was just talking to some transportation people yesterday that we're seeing, as we see more and more of our cars being, we hope, hybrid cars and ethanol, the only answer may not be the gas tax as we look at how we fund transportation and other things. That we may have to look at other funding sources. And as I said, I would like to sit back and look at all of our taxes, and I've talked about a few of them today, to make sure that they are not regressive, that they're not hurting the middle class, that the people who are working hard and going home every day and taking care of their kids or taking care of their mom and dad, that they're not hurt by these policies. So that's what I'd to look at first.
So you're not going to say a yes or no on a gas tax right now?
No.
Okay. Let's take another caller, Amber on the line from Minneapolis.
Hi. Yes, my question is where do you stand on trade? We need fair trade, and I've heard that you're for free trade. You seem to be kind of waffling on this issue.
You know, I couldn't be more clear on this issue, and I don't know where you got that indication. I was the first U.S. Senate candidate to be up at American Crystal. I did an event up there. I don't know if you're up in the Fargo-Moorhead area, but that's where we were, and I came out against CAFTA. I believe that we must have fair trade, not just free trade. And what bothers me about what happened with that CAFTA agreement is they didn't listen to people like Colin Peterson and Byron Dorgan and Kent Conrad. They just went off on their own and didn't put the labor standards and environmental standards that we should have. You know, we made progress with the Jordan trade agreement, and since then they've been backsliding. I think it's wrong. It reminds me of when you go back to the robber baron era, back in the late 1800s, we made changes in our laws to help people, you know, right to organize, environmental laws, child labor laws. We are now in the global economy, and there's many good things for Minnesota out of that. There's no doubt about it, but at the same time, we have to have trade agreements and laws that make sure that we're remembering why we're here, and that's to help improve people's lives in this country and in this state.
You know, on agricultural issues, what about these farm subsidies? Should a farmer who has a high income, you know, $250,000 a year, should they get farm subsidies?
You know, I support this cap that's been proposed for the $250,000 cap on farm subsidies. Actually, in Minnesota, the Farmers Union and other groups have supported this because most Minnesota farmers understand what these subsidies are for, and it's not for huge corporate conglomerates. But as a general matter, as I mentioned before, farm exports, 25% of our products here that we export out, our biggest export, and we must support our farm economy. I've come out with some ideas on farmers. I think we need to have country of origin labeling in place. You know, the administration keeps saying they want to do it. It'd be a great help to Minnesota, and the only thing they've done it for is seafood. Now, we don't have a lot of shrimp that's produced here in Minnesota, so I'd like to see country of origin labeling for Minnesota homegrown products and to continue fair prices for our farmers, and that's why this farm bill is so important in 2007. When you look back at the Freedom to Farm bill that we had, Colin Peterson, Paul Wellstone had to go in and fix it with the current farm bill. It's not perfect, but it's sure a lot better than what we had back there, and I don't want to go back to what we had back then. That was so bad for Minnesota farmers, and that's one of the reasons I want to be on the Agriculture Forestry Committee of the U.S.
But
Senate.
But the last farm bill was huge, wasn't it? And didn't it have a bunch of those subsidies in it for people who you could argue really didn't need them?
Well, there are some. That's why one of the reasons is that there's a lot of discussion about this $250,000 cap, which I support. Mm-hmm. There are some changes that can be made. But overall, we want to have that support in there for our farmers. I mean, things happen. You know, mm-hmm. droughts happen. Acts of God happen. And we have to be there for them because it is such an important export for Minnesota. And as I mentioned, and there's other things that we can do as well, like country of origin labeling.
Okay. Let's take a quick call. William from Minneapolis. Quickly, William.
Hi, Amy. I'm really impressed with what I hear from you, and I support you because you're such a progressive politician.
Well, and that's a great last question.
That's not a question.
I have an off-topic question here.
Quickly.
I get emails regularly from various people that I think are basically anti-government wondering why doesn't our legislature and Senate at the national level all go on Social Security and get rid of the fat pension plan that makes them all kind of prima donnas? And what would you think about being on Social Security rather than a pension plan as a result of serving?
You know, I think in general that, as I've said about opening up the health care plan, that the people of this country should get the same kind of benefits that the members of Congress get. And if, you know, they're not going to be doing their job, they shouldn't be getting a wage increase, and they shouldn't be getting these salary increases if they can't even balance the budget. So in that way, we're in agreement because I'm really sick and tired of what's going on in Washington in terms of not getting solutions for people for a change. And that's what I want to go and do in Washington. I've been doing it for the past 7 years, getting results, putting the interests of people first, and that's why I want to go to Washington, because I truly believe one senator from Minnesota can make a difference.
We are running a little short on time, but let me ask you this question. You know, Minnesota has never sent a woman to the U.S. Senate. Why do you think that is, and do you think that's an obstacle for you, or do you think it doesn't matter anymore?
Well, you know, they've sent women from Arkansas and Texas, and I think if those states can do it, we can. I do think that the past few races where women have run, there's been such a focus on, we got to get a woman, we got to get a woman. That's not how I'm running my campaign. I'm running it based on my record and what I want to do in Washington. And I'll end with one quick story. When I was up on the range talking to retired steelworkers, 200 of them, they were yelling at me like my relatives do when it's not even your fault. And it came to an end. A woman stood up. She says, "My name is Mrs. Rose Bradovich. I'm 65 years old, and you just talked for 45 minutes without notes, and our president can't do that." She then paused and she said, "You know, in my 65 years, I've never voted for a woman. I kind of think they should be home with their kids. But in your case, I'm making an exception." Hmm. We turned the corner with Rose. She sent three $20 checks in. And I know that we can overcome whatever thoughts there are along those lines, because this is really about change for Minnesota. It's really about putting the interests of the people first. I've got a record that supports I've done that. I've got experience not only to make change in Washington, but more importantly, right now, to win this election and take on these corporate special interests and take on Mark Kennedy and his pals, Karl Rove and George Bush and Dick Cheney. But this is going to be a real grassroots effort. It's not about gender. It's about putting Minnesota first.
Well, Amy Klobuchar, thank you so much for coming by today.
Well, it was great to be on, Mike. Look forward to being on again.
That's Amy Klobuchar. She is the Hennepin County attorney and also running for Senate as a DFLer. And I will just remind you that tomorrow We will have Ford Bell in our studio as part of our Meet the Candidate series. He is also running as a DFLer for the U.S. Senate. And then we will have the aforementioned Mark Kennedy, the Republican candidate. He'll be in our studios on March 2nd. So you can listen for that. Of course, we have much more on the campaign and the candidates at our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. So be sure to go there, too, for more information. And I'll just remind you that coming up after the news, we will hear a speech from former Reagan administration policy analyst Dinesh D'Souza, talking recently at St. John's University about anti-Americanism.
I'm Carrie Miller, and I hope you'll be there February 28th for our next Talking Volumes. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Marilynne Robinson will join me on the stage of the Fitzgerald Theater to talk about a book that was nearly 25 years in the writing. Critics have called Gilead radiant and luminous. So join me Tuesday, February 28th at 7 p.m. for Talking Volumes with Marilynne Robinson. Talking Volumes is a partnership between the Star Tribune, the Loft Literary Center, and Minnesota Public Radio.
This is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and streaming online at minnesotapublicradio.org. It's 25 degrees, partly cloudy in the Twin Cities right now, and that is about as warm as it will get today. Some clouds will move in tonight and a chance for snow as well, a low tonight around 8 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance for snow, especially in the morning, and a high tomorrow around 30. Again, right now in the Twin Cities, partly cloudy and 25 degrees.